I would say if the authorities didn't want us involved in the public square, they ought not to have crucified Jesus in the public square.
Use humanistic principles.
Well, I would say
the same idea.
I would say
same
that.
End.
I would say, what's the problem with Stardust bumping into Stardust?
In the cosmic picture, no, there's no problem. In the cosmic picture, it won't matter.
No, Mr. President, you are not protecting reproductive freedom. You are authorizing the destruction of freedom for 1 million little human beings every year.
I'm sorry, my friends, but I am tired of seeing Jesus presented as a weak beggar. He is a powerful savior, and the gospel is not a suggestion, it is a command.
Reverend Mola, don't you sympathize with that?
I sympathize with every single human heart wishing to know the one true and living God, but I believe there's only one way that that can happen, through Jesus Christ, and the gospel is about repenting of sin, not celebrating it.
Right now, you're on the threshold of an amazing adventure. We will explore the spiritual abyss. You have not experienced this before. You're gonna love it.
Great is your mercy, O Lord. Give me life according to your rules. Many are my persecutors and my adversaries, but I do not swerve from your testimonies. I look at the faithless with disgust because they do not keep your commands. Consider how I love your precepts. Give me life according to your steadfast love. The sum of your word is truth, and every one of your righteous rules endures forever. Princes persecute me without cause, but my heart stands in awe of your words. I rejoice at your word like one who finds great spoil. I hate and abhor falsehood, but I love your law. 7 times a day I praise you for your righteous rules. Great peace have those who love your law. Nothing can make them stumble. Boy, oh boy. Psalm 119. You get to know it, guys. I know it's the longest chapter in the Bible, so many people avoid, you know, especially don't start church with like a reading of Psalm 119, because you're going to be there a while.
Got to break it up.
It'd be the whole service. Like, all right, everybody, we're going to do Psalm 119 today, and we're just going to read. And it's all about God's law, and I'll tell you what, that is as true today as when it was first given by the Holy Spirit of God. And boy, oh boy, do we see it now? Do we understand how beautiful God's law is and how it is the standard of justice and righteousness in the world? And, you know, one of the great things about the last week that I have been grateful to God for, and it's a humbling experience when you sort of sit back and look at this, is since the inception of Apologia Radio, we have been... We didn't. Obviously, we saw sort of like what's on the horizon. But we didn't know how fast this was going to come down and strike us. But we
I don't think anybody did.
Yeah, we have been for a decade now on Apologia Radio. We have been talking about the goodness of God's law, that it's the standard for righteousness and justice in every society. God's law is good for the sinner who can't actually accomplish God's law and obey God's law. Of course, there's a curse element to that. And that's why we need Christ. Christ becomes a curse for us, and we have his righteousness. Salvation is a gift from God. But the law of God in Scripture is not just displayed as a curse upon a fallen people. It's also talked about as good, as their wisdom in the sight of the peoples. It is the thing that God gives to his people that was supposed to be something that created awe in the people surrounding Israel, because they see, well, this is righteousness. This is justice. And I might add that one of the things that my heart's been sort of dwelling on the last week is that in the beginning of this great American experiment, there was a worldview and there was a culture behind all of it. And that worldview and culture just had as a basic assumption the goodness of God's law, and that this was the very reference point for all questions and certainty. And of course, you have the New England pulpit, and I talk about it a lot. The sermons from the founding era and the political era before the Declaration of Independence and the Constitution, you had people who were men of God who were preaching across a pulpit, speaking to the issues in their day from the reference point of the law of God. And when they were talking about the injustices being perpetrated upon the colonies or what have you, they weren't just saying, you know, I really don't like this. It makes me uncomfortable. They were saying this is a violation of God's law. The king claims to be a Christian king, and he's violating God's law. And so, of course, you have all the stories of the Black Robe Regiment and all the pastors that were actually preaching against the injustices that were happening to them. They had a long historical Christian tradition that they were appealing to, of course, to the Word of God. And then they would pick up their muskets and they would fight. And I was watching John Adams. It's been recommended to me a million times before, but I decided last night to start watching. And I told Joy and Luke as I came in today, I watched two or three episodes last night. Mm. And I would say I love it. I thought it was wonderful. And I was sad. I was very, very sad when I was watching it because I thought to myself, we aren't worthy. Now, not everything in that show is completely accurate. But we aren't worthy of these men. We aren't worthy of these women. When you look around us today at the culture that we have now allowed to grow into fruition around the Christian church, we aren't worthy of those men and what they understood and what they gave to us, the courage. It's definitely a sad situation, but it's something that we should look at and say, what's wrong? How do we build from here? How do we preach the gospel and expand the kingdom of God in the midst of it? So this is Apologia Radio, everybody. We're doing a very important show today with our friend Zach Lautschlager. I think you're really going to be blessed by this, especially in the context that we're in right now with the Capitol breach and the Capitol riots that took place. We were eyewitnesses to it. We were on the ground. No, we did not participate in any way in it. It's funny, I posted that video where I was defrosting in my hotel room. Uh-huh. Man, it was cold there. I mean, it hurt. It was cold.
I think so Zach cold. Would debate you on that, but
what?
How cold it was.
Lautschlager?
Yeah.
I think he thought it was
cold. He was
cold
wearing
too.
Like a t-shirt.
Was he really? I forget what he was wearing. Yeah, and I think he was cold too. Actually, at one point when we were doing an interview, we were all freezing and shaking. While I was defrosting, I put this video up. It was seen by like 200,000 people. And a bunch of, I mean, it's wide open, so a bunch of leftists and liberals jumped on it, and they were like, I'm reporting you, you were at the Capitol breach, you're going to jail, ha ha ha. I was like, do you even watch long enough to see a sustained discussion or argument? No, I was there, so I'm guilty. Anyway, we were eyewitnesses to it, and
Nancy Pelosi was there too, does she need to be
she
taken
was
in?
The breach, baby. So we were eyewitnesses. Zach was eyewitness. We were there to provide Christian, distinctly Christian commentary on what was happening that day. So we were there with our media crew. We definitely are so sorry that we weren't able to live stream. We even got all this new technology and equipment, and you're still going to get to see that stuff and even get to really be blessed by some of the technology we have now that is really awesome. It's like we have a studio there on the spot. We can change cameras. We have roaming cameras that are wirelessly connected to our stuff. It's just amazing, and we couldn't touch any of it. I couldn't make a phone call. I couldn't send a text message. I couldn't call if there was an emergency. I mean, there were so many people there. The towers were overloaded, apparently, and you couldn't do a thing. And so we were there, and of course, the breach happened. So we're going to do a show today with Zach Lautschlager on the Boston Tea Party and the Capitol breach or Capitol riots. There are people, of course, who were trying to compare the two, saying, you know, this is how our nation started. We were founded on this kind of stuff. Well, we're going to ask that question. What was the Boston Tea Party? Mind you, and Luke is aware of this, and so is Zach, we actually had this discussion fairly recently.
Yeah, we did.
And nobody cared. Nobody paid attention because there was no context. Like, why do I care about the Boston Tea Party and what they did? Well, now you'll care. Now you'll see. So I wanted to today talk with Zach, talk about the Boston Tea Party, talk about the Capitol breach, give you guys the insight from on the ground, what happened while we were there, talk about some current event stuff, and then more importantly, really start to say, okay, now how do you build from here? Because enough with the pessimism, historical pessimism, enough with the historical defeatism within the church. Do you see what it gave us? Can I just get on my soapbox for a moment here? Do you see what defeatism in the church has gotten us? Do you see what the eschatology of defeat has gotten us? It's gotten us this culture, the culture of the West. The Puritans, their eschatology, the dominant eschatology early on was postmillennialism. I'm not trying to make you a fan of postmillennialism. I'm not trying to convert you. I'm just trying to tell you the story. Okay, when you look at historical Christian tradition and like what developed the world that they were in, their eschatology was an eschatology of optimism and dominion of the gospel itself and the kingdom of Christ. And they built civilizations that way based upon Christ as king, it's Christ or chaos, And this is the word of God. This should be the regulating principle that's above all of our heads. Like, there's a context. So all these Christians understood that the king had authority and power that was derivative. It was derived from God. And he had to answer to God. And they understood that the king, though he had authority, and though they should respect, and all of those things were supposed to be there. Romans 13, of course, the prescriptive role of government is to be God's servant. They understood that, but they understood that the king's power was derivative. They understood that he wasn't the ultimate. The government wasn't the ultimate. They had a worldview that made sense of the creation of this great American experiment. Now, I am not saying to any degree that America was ever a utopia. I'm not saying to any degree that the Puritans did everything purely, that perfectly. It's not a utopia. We're sinners, and God is sanctifying his church, and he's sanctifying individuals. But you can't ignore the great blessings of justice and freedom and liberty, all that stuff that was there and that we've sort of been hanging on to barely, that all came from biblical worldview. And these people all understood that. Now, when we abandon, as the church, we say, no, actually, see, here's the thing. Jesus is king over the spiritual realm, but there's an earthly kingdom that it's just going to rule, and Jesus isn't really so concerned with, like, this life and this world. We just need to escape our bodies and go to heaven one day. That's the ultimate. Totally akin to Gnosticism, totally anti-biblical worldview, and totally foreign to much of what church history has believed about this world and Christ's authority and all the rest. But when we think about the context, we think about the context of the modern evangelical church has believed that the law of God is this oppressive, horrible system that's just a curse. Thank God we're released from those shackles, right? It's just over with and done with. You know, Jesus saved us from the very mean, wrathful God of the Old Testament. All he was is about law, and Jesus is about grace, mercy, and love, and truth. And so thank God we're out of that burden of that great law thing. Well, we believe that like Jesus isn't concerned with this world and like in it's just a throwaway. We're just going to get zapped out of our pants here in a minute. And the law of God doesn't apply to society today. And you know, Christians in politics, that's it. That's the earthly realm. Jesus is a spiritual realm, you know, leader. He's not concerned with politics. Well, is it making sense to you yet that there's all this immorality around and it's coming from legislation and it's coming from the top? Isn't it amazing that when you take Christians who have the law of God right before their eyes out of the conversation about morality in politics, all of a sudden you start seeing darkness, corruption, evil, and all kinds of evil legislation coming your way. Well, why? Because Christians said all along, you know, that's just a political thing. Christians shouldn't be about politics. Really? I think Matthew 28, 18 through 20 knocks that one out of the park. Sure. It's done. Jesus says he has all authority in heaven and on earth. That means here and now. And the Puritans understood that. The Covenanters understood that. The Huguenots or Huguenots, however you want to say it, they understood that. The early colonies understood the law of God was the reference point in the standard, and we don't, and look what we've got. So if you want to chime in, I have much more to sort of introduce this to, but, you know.
I was just going to say that I survived the Rona and Joy.
Yes!
We did.
Yes, we have two.
Survived the Rona.
We have two that survived the Rona. How was the experience? Was
it was bad, but not the worst thing.
Just mostly tired.
Mostly tired.
Mostly tired.
Yeah, and you know, obviously you were very blessed to have not, like, we didn't have to worry about, you know, like, finances and, like, there are people who definitely are in a better, I don't want to make it seem like if you know someone that was affected by Corona, it's like NBD, but yeah, it was,
NBD, y'all.
But yeah, so we're very blessed, but we were also blessed, I think, well, I think you got hit harder than me, Luke, but
yeah.
I had a few days of just feeling worse than I've ever felt, but not like, I wasn't headed to the hospital or anything like that.
I mean, I'm 99%. Sure, I just need to go get the antibody test to see it, but I got it back at the end of January because I had everything everyone describes about it, nailed it, every single one of them, and it was pretty treacherous for 5 days, and it was awful. I mean, it really was awful, and it took about a month to fully recover. I felt tired. Yeah. I had to keep taking naps.
I think Luke and I are still not 100%.
Yeah, I'm glad you're better, though.
But
I did get to see Luke. You and you as well. I got to see Luke. We did a big Zoom call meeting for Apologia Studios in Anna Bochanal. And we had been in meetings. Luke and I had been meetings all morning and into the afternoon. And so I think it was the last bit of it. I saw Luke. I literally saw it on a Zoom call.
I was,
he was out.
That's when
he was
hit
out.
Me. I was melting slowly.
Okay, so yeah, let's go ahead. I want to talk about current event stuff to lead us into the discussion. So we're going to go quickly today. Thank you all for watching. You're going to learn a lot in this episode, I assure you. Zach Lautenschlager is one of my heroes. He truly is. I know he wouldn't personally feel like that, but this man is a genius and he's a blessing to the church. And you need to get to know him. So Zach, welcome to Apologia Radio, brother.
Thank you.
You sound pretty far away. I'm not sure how that sounds in your end, guys.
Quiet.
Yeah.
Is that better?
That's a little better. Isaac, how's it sounding to you, Isaac?
Fixes.
Go ahead, Zach. Say some stuff to us. I want you to tell everybody who you are.
Guys.
There you go.
Sorry about that. I was waiting for you. Thank you for having me on. I really appreciate it. It was a pleasure and an honor to be with you guys in D.C. last week. Really enjoy working with you on multiple operations.
Yes, we had a great
Jeff,
time.
You're a blessing.
You're a gift to me, brother. And actually, just as a side, we'd like to always bring you guys into our lives and really allow you to get to know us. Zach introduced us. We were going to go to Dulles to catch our flight back. He introduced us to an amazing, amazing gelato place. In D.C. I did eat two large.
He didn't eat anything else except for gelato.
Well, it was just when we were leaving. If I'd been introduced to it on day one, we would have probably gone there about four or five times a day.
Zach would have definitely regretted it.
He would have. He would have.
Not even close. I'd go there as many times as Jeff would.
Yeah, I mean, it's...
There's something else we'll talk about later.
What's it called? What's it called, Zach?
Patango gelato. There
Patango.
Are multiple locations all over D.C.
Yeah.
You didn't even get to go to Friendly's, did you?
I did not. We didn't get to do anything. D.C. was like on straight-up lockdown. Let me just say this right now, how horrible the experience was to go to D.C. and, like, the first night, we're like, where are we going to eat? Nothing is open. I mean, it's horrible. The people are being treated just horribly there. So we're like, well, here's a place we can go eat. We go there late. And it was like the only option available is, like, a really fancy restaurant. And so we go there, and there's six tables outside. Outside, the restaurant is completely empty. The people who are in the restaurant, the workers look so depressed and like sad inside. But it's completely empty. It's like a ghost town. There's like five or six tables outside. And they were like, don't worry. It's about 20 degrees warmer in here outside than it is outside. No, lies. Lies. It was outside and it was as cold as it was outside. We're wearing our coats and everything else. Like,
well, I've heard this thing about them signing something into place that allows you to take like a $4,000 tax credit. Like, you can write it off right off of vacation as long as you travel over 50 miles, like outside of where you live. But like, nobody wants to go anywhere right now because you want to eat outside?
What are you going to do?
You want to eat outside in the winter?
So the first place we ate at.
Especially when you live in Arizona, you're like, why would I go somewhere colder at knowing that I can't be inside?
The silliest thing was like, it was okay, let's bring the inside outside and make another inside outside. So it was
so
like this
heaters
is,
and stuff.
It was just, or... it was a tent. You're in a tent outside,
right.
So you're inside.
Right.
But
what are the museums?
The museums are all closed down. They're all, everything's closed. Yeah. So the next day, we're trying to find another place and to eat just like, I feel like the food situation was horrible on this trip because we couldn't get a lot of things to eat. So we go to a sandwich place and they make you sit outside and they had, it was freezing outside. And man, it was so cold, bitter cold.
Zach, how cold was it? Hello?
Uh-oh. Did we lose him?
Did we lose him?
Oh, no, there he is.
We lost your audio again. Can you hear him?
Yeah,
we don't have Zach's audio. Well, anyway, I'll describe it to you and just ignore everything Zach says. Okay, so it was cold, and so we get sandwiches. We have to eat them outside, but also when you're buying the sandwiches, you had to give them information for contact tracing just to buy a sandwich. And, I mean, it was just an awful experience. And then when the mayor locked the city down, now this is the amazing thing to me. I just got to say this. Look, call it hypocrisy and consistency where you find it. If you find it in Christians, call it out. Call it out on yourself. Call it out where you see it. We got to be honest, have integrity. That's what you have to do. The crazy thing was when the Capitol breach happened, things popped off quickly, and it was kind of crazy. Police are coming in and everything else. The mayor wasted no time.
It was immediately.
No time. To send everybody, you got like thousands of people all at once. You hear
emergency
thing, and it's like there's it's 6 p.m. lockdown and curfew in the city, and I'm like,
And I think that was at around 3.
How fast did you respond like that when they were burning buildings in D.C. or trying to set the place on fire, or they were hitting people and there were attacks happening in D.C. I wonder how fast you did it then. I thought that was very peculiar. But anyway, so we go back to the hotel and now we're like, what are we going to eat? We haven't used the bathroom all day. They've locked the city down. There's no bathrooms. I mean, there's got like hundreds of thousands of people there that can't use the bathroom. I mean, people were literally going on trees in the wide open because there was no place to go. And no food anywhere really. No food anywhere really to speak of. And then they lock the city down. So I go back to the hotel and I say to the guy behind the counter, I was like, hey, bro, where do we eat? Starbucks closed immediately. They were like 6 p.m. curfew. They still had like 3 hours left and they were like, we're done. So you can't even get like a sandwich at Starbucks or something like that. So I go to the guy at the thing. I'm like, where are we going to eat? He's like, man, I don't know. He's like, I live in D.C. I didn't have any food in the fridge. I was going to go grocery shopping afterwards. He's like, I don't know what I'm going to eat tonight. So even the locals were impacted. So I call a restaurant in Virginia because Crystal City is like
right there,
10 minutes away from where we were in D.C. And I call Virginia and they're like, our governor told us we're locked down. Virginia? Now, I don't know if that's completely true, but I called two restaurants that said that Virginia was also on lockdown. I'm like, the state of Virginia. So like Virginians in the South as well. Like they what did that look like? Part of Virginia? I never looked into it to figure out the details, but it was absolute like mayhem when it comes to that. And you would have really suffered because the bear needs his food.
Yeah, I don't know. I would have. It's funny because I was talking about that. I don't know who I was talking to, but I was like, I think everyone knows that if I was there, I would have had the food situation taken care of ahead of time.
Right. Like you just stockpile in the room.
You wouldn't have ran into that problem. Like, I would have known what was available and where we could have gone and maybe had it in my backpack or something. So
just a snack pack. He carries around a snack pack. Do we have Zach back?
Yeah.
We do?
I'm here.
Oh, there you go. Okay. All right. So just quick things while everyone's watching right now, just to update and like current event stuff. Unusual things. So I find it unusual, peculiar, interesting, to say the least, that let's see, January 14th, 2021, CBS to Chicago staff. It says Mayor Lori Lightfoot wants to reopen restaurants and bars as quickly as possible to reduce risk of underground parties. I think it's interesting that as soon as we know for sure that Biden is going to be the president, you've got a lot of Democratic mayors that were just like hardcore gangster, like lockdown. We're going to be here for like, you know, indefinite period of time and all the rest. And as soon as it's all good, you know, Biden, they're like, you know, we need to go ahead and open. Or who is it? Cuomo that said, like, if we don't open now, there's nothing going to be open. Nothing going to be left to open. And I'm like, well, that's interesting.
Interesting. We've been saying that for 6 months.
Yeah. How many businesses were killed from the last 6 months till now who have been saying that? Like, if you don't open, I'm going to die. And everyone's like, no, you sit tight. We're going to be fine. And then as soon as Biden is officially going to take that position, then it's like, you know, we need to go ahead and open up. Let's go ahead and do that.
That's what the Rona's gone. It disappeared. It vanished.
Yeah, it's interesting. Hmm. Let's see.
Doesn't exist anymore.
So just to bring you guys in to the discussion, because I think it's good to show it. This is from the recent 60 Minutes episode interviewing Nancy Pelosi, Grandma Gugu, about what happened during the Capitol breach. And let me just say, I got to say right now, look, I love this woman. I'm called to love her, called to love my enemies. She's an image bearer of God. She has value, respect, and dignity, but she's a wicked, wicked woman.
Yeah.
Okay, you can say it. Like, I just read to you Psalm 119 about looking with disgust on people who violate God's law. So we ought to look at Nancy Pelosi as an object of our evangelism, but at the same time have a category of disgust. Mm-hmm. This woman is a wretched, vile woman, and her policies are wicked. They violate God's law. She has judgment on our nation, supreme judgment on our nation. And so this is Nancy Pelosi talking with 60 Minutes about the Capitol breach. Here you go.
Clashing with police and breaking into the Capitol. As they swarmed through the halls, the speaker was on the House floor during the count of the Electoral College vote.
Oh, look. So tell us what happened when the protesters were trying to get in here. You're up there.
Well, when the protesters were making the assault on the Capitol, before they even got to these doors,
she always is very careful about her words
Oh, yeah.
and definitions. the protesters making the assault on the Capitol. Okay, but just remember that Nancy Pelosi is a tactical opportunist, is the word I use, because you know what an opportunist is. I call them tactical opportunists because it's their strategy, right? It's not just opportunists. It's their strategy to take advantage of everything, to spin it. And so she's very careful about definitions, but I wanted you to see, just watch.
Capitol Police pulled me from the podium, and I was concerned because I said, no, I want to be here. And they said, well, no, you have to leave. I said, no, I'm not leaving. They said, no, you must leave.
Police, guns drawn, held the invaders off the House floor. But over in the Senate, the Trump supporters were able to break into the chamber. The scenes were shocking to watch.
I think there was a universally accepted that what happened. Was a terrible, terrible violation of what of the Capitol, of the first branch of government, the legislative branch.
Sorry, that was the fakest cry I've ever seen. I mean, my 6-year-old does a better job of than that.
That's right.
Fantastic emotion and action. So let's talk real fast. So I need to announce, if you didn't see the stuff that I did on Facebook, and yes, everybody, we are, of course, migrating a lot of content over to Rumble. We'll be on those other platforms as well. I'm not leaving YouTube and Facebook and all that stuff until they throw me off. And so we will be migrating everything over there. But I was on Facebook and did a video, and I just said, look, we got to have integrity as Christians. When we see error, we got to point it out no matter where it is. If it's in us, we got to point it out. If it's in them, we got to point it out. Be consistent. We condemn the rioting and the looting and the assault and all the stuff that was taking place over the last year with the BLM nonsense and all of that trash that was being thrown into our streets. Yeah, exactly. Chaz Chunk Chopped in Portland or whatever. We condemn that because it's right to condemn it. And so it doesn't make any sense to turn around and do it yourselves. And of course, we were in D.C. when this took place. We were on the ground. We were eyewitnesses. Zach and I were together watching people pour water on their faces to get the pepper spray off of their faces and all the rest. We talked to these people. And I started seeing right away people throwing out these memes with like Jake, the weirdo shaman guy. He's a local here. Like Luke's had interaction locally with that guy. He's just a nutter. He totally is a nutter. And he tries to create conflict wherever he's at. He's been at BLM marches locally because he tries to create conflict. And he's yelled at their side. He's yelled at our side. He's part of like the Arizona Third Party or something like that. It's
Patriot Party.
Something like that. So he's a local from Arizona. And people were like taking pictures of him. Look, he was at a BLM march. He's with Antifa, all the rest. Look, we got to be honest, okay? The guy is not. The people that were coming in there, were there Antifa people there? Let me just say, I 100% believe yes.
Well, they've proven that.
There were Antifa people there. Of course, you can demonstrate that. But, you know, when people show up to the Capitol and they just have a certain look to them, they're not making eye contact with people, you know, they're staying away from people, they're
carrying
wearing Trump gear,
gas masks,
carrying gas masks on their
bricks.
On their book bags. You're like, I think I know what you're up to. So the answer is, sure, Antifa was there. They antagonized. They caused problems. But let's have enough integrity to say that that this was also legitimate Trump people.
Oh, yeah.
All right, be sober about it.
Well, it's not the first time we've never said that like Trump equals holiness or Republican equals obedience. Like we've never made that claim ever. So why we would never make that now, claim now.
Yeah, we're Christians. Now, I want to announce to everyone who's watching, totally concerned with the election fraud. Believe that there is strong evidence of some massive election fraud. Believe it. I think that could be demonstrated. I wish that it was. But the truth is, what took place at the Capitol with that foolishness removed any opportunity to actually have a sober, balanced look at any votes. I thought Ted Cruz's speech was excellent. I don't want to overturn anything. I want to do what we've done before, assign a team of people to for 10 days to examine this, Supreme Court justices, bipartisan, just examine it. We've done it before. Let's do it again. Can't hurt anything. That's sober. That's balanced. Give the American people confidence that there was not enough election fraud to overturn this thing. Give everyone confidence. What's wrong with that? Nothing wrong with that. And it was all thrown in the trash. Mm-hmm. It's all done away with, put right into the gutter. Why? Because a bunch of fools decided to do something that actually wasn't proportionate to what they should have done. You had people there that were legitimate, normally sober, Trump people, pouring water in their faces, and they got hit with the throat with a pepper ball. And my response to them was, looks like you had it coming. You know, we had a guy come up to us. He was like, oh, I'm a big fan of your ministry, all the rest. You want to see a video? What video? A video of us going in and, like, climbing over the banister and, like, going onto the floor. I was like, well, you did that? Yeah, check it out. And, like, super, like, bragging about it. And I was like, why would you do that? You totally foolish.
Lawlessness.
So, Zach, I'd like you to just start that conversation in terms of introduce us to what you saw and what were you concerned with most, because you were on the ground and you were even seeing people that we know that were, you know, posting things or even talking about what was happening in a positive way. So just bring us back into your emotion and your thinking from that moment.
Well, when we roll up to the Capitol, the first attempt to break down the doors had apparently already happened. And so there were those dudes out back who were trying to wash the tear gas out of their faces. And that's when we asked them, hey, what's going on? Oh, and they were kind of shamefaced. These are, you know, 50, 60 something Bubba's from West Virginia. And no offense to my West Virginia friends. You got a few Bubba's. And they're like, oh, well, we were breaking down the door and got pepper sprayed, and they were sheepish about it. And so we're like, well, why did you do that? Well, I don't know. Everyone else was. And so we walk around to the west side, which is where everybody's familiar with that side. That's where the inaugurations are. And so that's where we saw people up, you know, not just up on the steps, but running around trying to get inside. I have one friend who was texting something, and I actually called him and said, are you participating in this? Yeah, we got to do something. We got to do something. We have to make him listen. And I told him, there is violence. They are breaking stuff. People are getting hurt. That's not a political protest. That's a riot. And that's wrong. And he kind of said, well, yeah, you're right. I'm not going to participate in the violence. And to my knowledge, he didn't actually go inside. Honestly, if everyone had done what that guy did, what my friend did, and had simply gone a little bit past the, you know, the barricades outside and stood on the steps you're not supposed to stand on, would have got a little news, but that hadn't been about it. I don't have a serious problem with that. But when you start breaking stuff and hurting people, when you start damaging property and threatening persons, whether either their well-being or their lives, and both were threatened and both were taken by both sides, now you are becoming a tyrant yourself. What is tyranny but the threatening of property and persons? That's what it is. There's very little else. And so is there a time for self-defense? Is there a time for shooting back violence in the sense of defending ourselves in hot war? Sure. Theoretically, yes. Did our forefathers go there? Well, yes, they were forced to. Eventually, the British marched out of Boston with men with guns and didn't just say, hey, don't go in the Capitol building. They said, where your leaders were arresting them and were taking all your stuff. Mm-hmm. And even at that point on Lexington Green, when Major Pitcairn of the British Army said, disperse, you rebels, they turned around and went home. They went to leave because that was a lawful order. But then he yelled, lay down your arms. And they looked at one another and shook their heads and just kept walking. And that's when the British soldiers, unbidden, opened fire, and then our side returned fire. So there's a lot of equivocation going on, and I think that's something we have to look at. There's a lot of, hey, we're at war. Well, what do we mean by that? We talk about political fights, right? We talk about, man, this is a real war. We're not actually talking about hot war. We're talking about a political war. We're talking about a culture war. And I see friends conflating the two. Well, you know, it was okay to break in because we're at war. Really? Really? No, then we're not. That's ridiculous. That's laughable. No one actually thinks that. You don't think that. You mean there's a cultural war. And so the level of political ignorance of historic ignorance on our side is appalling, and we need to catch up. We need to recognize. See that.
Yeah, you were making that point, Zach, quite a bit last week in terms of the founding fathers and people who were involved in the beginning of this great American experiment they had to deal with people. There's always people who want to tar and feather. Mm-hmm. And right. you mentioned that they were actually opposed to that sort of a thing, and they militated against it. And so bring us into that whole tarring and feathering and this sort of like eruption into chaos and like we just let go of all the rules and all the rest. What do you mean that they would have opposed that? Like what are some examples?
Right. Well, and you mentioned HBO's John Adams with Paul Giamatti playing Adams. It's a tremendously well done series, but it portrays Adams in the first episode participating in a tarring and feathering. And I don't yell at my screen that much, but I have a hard time not yelling at the TV right there. That is wrong, and it's historically inaccurate. Even Wikipedia, which has been edited recently since the riots this summer, the BLM and Antifa riots, they've edited out some of the facts and the founding fathers opposing rioting, because the left just months ago was saying, oh, well, you know, physical violence, riots, that's an essential American principle. And that's when we said, no, it's not. That's ridiculous. And every one of those dudes who broke into the Capitol, I guarantee if they were at all aware, were incensed at anyone suggesting that the violence this summer was comparable to the Boston Tea Party.
Yeah.
Or the Boston Massacre. And now, of course, our side jumps on to say, oh, well, it's like the Boston Massacre. Talk about hypocrisy. That's what really bothers me. That's the problem. And so there's a continuum. There's also a lot of discussion. Well, you know, because we crossed, I had one friend, a lawyer from Texas, who said, well, because Washington crossed the Delaware, therefore breaking the Capitol is fine. The level of cognitive dissonance is unbelievable, and historical ignorance. That was the late 1770s. This all started in the 1760s, more than a decade before that. Do you have any idea what happened in those intervening 10 years? Have you ever read history at all? So the reality was that everything kind of came to a head for the colonies in about 1765. That's when George III took over. He was the grandson of the ruling king, who died and became king. And George III took a much harder line towards the colonies. And the problem was he had a government which was deeply in debt after the Seven Years' War. On this continent, our participation was called the French and Indian War. But this was a global conflict between France and England, of which the American colonies only played a small part. So, you know, there's a lot I could get into and I could go long, but I will just say this. Everything that happened at the time of the American Revolution and leading up to it was about who is our government. You see, when the British came here, when the English colonists came here, whether it was the Pilgrims or the Puritans or everyone else who followed, or people from other nations who also colonized here and lived under our form of government, all of it was formed as a separate colony which had its own legislature equal to the British Parliament. And all of them were then under the king. We have an echo of that in our modern government, which you have a House and a Senate, and then you have an executive branch. The colonies had their own House and Senate, so to speak. England had their own House and Senate, and that was the House of Commons and the House of Lords. And then all of them acknowledged and were subservient to the king. In the American colonies, of course, with the intervening time it took at that time to get from one to the other, you had a royal governor who had a lot of leeway, but he was the representation of the king, and they respected that. Well, the problem was, and this was always a problem, it had been argued over since the very beginning, what about when Parliament wants to make laws for the colonies? And it was a constant conflict, and you had all these extended legal arguments about whether or not the American colonists were represented in Parliament. Of course, they weren't. There were no representation. There was no representation in Parliament. Parliament had no authority here, and they guarded that very jealously, because where does the assault on liberty come from? Well, just right around the time of the Stamp Act in 1765, which is really what set everything off, you had Parliament establishing a state church in the neighboring colony of what we now call Canada. They had their own parliaments. They had their own, they were under the rule of the king, same as us, but they didn't fight back when Parliament tried to take control. So the entire thing was about who is going to control, who is going to legislate here, and who is the ultimate authority. It is the legislative body. The legislative body is the ultimate authority. So when George came to the throne, you had a new government was formed. That's how they do it there. You have multiple parties, and the parties have to coalesce an ally in order to elect a prime minister and to set up everything. And so there's a new prime minister elected, and they decided, hey, we're going to tax the colonies. We're going to, and they called them the colonies and the plantations. And so they levied a tax. It was called the Stamp Act, popularly. And that was, we think of stamps as in lick and stick, but this was, you know, an actual piece of metal with a wooden handle that you stamped paper with, like an embossing or with ink. And it was required that you buy these stamps in order to use paper for most things, including all business paper. So all business records had to be stamped with the king's stamp, and you had to pay money in order to do it. So it was a rank tax levied by a foreign legislative body. If you got a tax bill from Canada, would you pay it? Or would
I'd set it on fire on a Facebook Live video.
Right. Yeah. Or you might just chuckle and throw it in the garbage.
Yeah.
Too, right. I mean, it depends on what's going on. But once it becomes a thing, no, you don't pay tax to a foreign government. And that is what the Parliament was. And that was the colonist argument. We would not pay tax to France, and we're not paying tax to the English Parliament. They would say the same thing. If you lived in Massachusetts and you got a tax bill from Virginia, you would laugh and throw it away. That's the way it works. If you get a tax bill from a state in which you don't reside and you've never been to and you don't owe tax there, you don't pay it. But was it about the money? Well, no. Get this. Samuel Adams, one of my favorite founding fathers, was a tax collector for the colony. And he was revered. He was honored, partially because he was reasonable in the way he collected taxes. And sometimes he paid the taxes himself for people. But everyone acknowledges that, hey, of course we pay tax to our colony. And of course, some of that money goes, a lot of that money goes to the British Crown. That's how it's supposed to be done. But it was a question of authority. And so Parliament directly was trying to claim authority over all the colonies, not only economically, but also politically and religiously, which they clearly demonstrated when they established a state church in Canada around the same time. Okay, so in 1765, you have the beginning of the implementation of the Stamp Act, and both sides were surprised. Our side was as surprised as the Loyalists that the American colonists were ferociously opposed to the Stamp Act, and it wasn't just about the money. What everyone said is, if we pay a dime, a penny in tax, we will be acknowledging that Parliament has authority to pass laws for us. When they said no taxation without representation, it was the representation that was debated. It wasn't the tax. It wasn't about whether or not we're going to pay tax. They were already paying tax. Some of the most popular founding fathers were tax collectors for the colony. It wasn't about the tax. It was about who has the authority to make law here. And so we'll talk a little bit about what happened. There were street demonstrations. Some of them turned violent. But in order to demonstrate the point that it wasn't about the tax, after all the demonstrations and there was a successful reining in of violence in 1766, the repeal of the Stamp Act was passed by Parliament because they were financially hurting. It did the opposite of some of what they wanted. But what did they do? They passed the Declaratory Act. So look it up. It's the very next stage in the battle. The war, and that's a culture war, against British rule. And what did the Declaratory Acts say? Well, you colonies still have to do what we say. They declared their authority over the colonies. Parliament did. And so that's what it was about. Now, going back to what happened after they passed the Stamp Act, and when everyone starts referring to the Boston Tea Party or the Boston Massacre, it's because they're ignorant. They don't know that it actually started 10 years before with the Stamp Act riots, which were legitimately at times riots. There is a little known body of men called the Loyal Nine. They were the predecessors to the Sons of Liberty. One of them was a cousin of Samuel Adams. Another one was a close friend and former schoolmate of Dr. Joseph Warren. These guys were all upper middle class tradesmen and businessmen. One, they worked in bronze. They were called mechanics in the same way that Paul Revere as a silversmith was a mechanic. They worked with their hands, but they would be very similar to contractors today, businessmen who do very well for themselves but work with their hands. And They were a secret society. The only way we know who they were is because at the end of the Stamp Act fight in 1766, they invited John Adams to come meet with them, and he recorded who was there. They later became part of the Sons of Liberty and were probably recruited by Sam Adams. Hmm. But they
make some,
were the...
Some popular beer, Sam Adams.
Correct.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, some of that's really good beer. Boston Brick Red, which is only served in Boston, is a ton of fun. You go sit at the bar that... Daniel Webster used to sit at, the actual bar in Union Oyster House, and sit there and eat oysters and drink beer, or whatever your preference is. So Samuel Adams, the man, started coordinating with these nine men, the Loyal Nine. He was not one of them, but he organized with them and led them into the right modes of action. So they decided, we need to demonstrate. Look at all this opposition we have. We need to demonstrate against this. So let's organize a street demonstration. We've never done this before. What's the best way to do this? Well, they looked around and they said, hey, there is an annual street demonstration every year in Boston. It was called Pope Day. It was on November 5th. So how many know, remember the 5th of November? That is what modern people call Guy Fawkes Day. Now, modern libertarians like Guy Fawkes. But what they don't know, or what they don't care to know, is that he was actually a terrorist. He was trying to blow up the Houses of Parliament when they were largely Protestant-controlled 100 years before. It was a Catholic plot to destroy any effort to have Protestant government. And so it was a bit of a mess. We can talk about Oliver Cromwell, who was kind of the Trump of his day. We can talk about everything that goes around that. But by this time, this was a big street demonstration, and the north side of Boston and the south side of Boston each had their own street gang. And every year, it was a means of entertainment for these two gangs to get together and have fairly violent face-offs in which they beat one another, had fist fights in the street, and whoever won got to burn the Pope in effigy.
Gangs in New York.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, think about the games in New York, 100 years before, in Boston. These guys are not nice guys. Eventually, a 12-year-old boy is killed in the rioting on the 5th, and they're not even demonstrating what I think. They're just showing up to fight because they want to fight. It wasn't even, you know, gangs in New York, they were at least trying to control something economically. You know, in this case, these guys, and it's a big deal. Look up Pope's Day on November 5th. Now, the leader of the South Side gang is the most popular part of this. So if you look up Ebenezer McIntosh, you will see, and that's a good way to start reading about it. McIntosh was an interesting guy. He was definitely not a very nice guy, and he was the leader of the South Side gang. And the South Side of Boston consistently won the riots on the 5th of November for who would get to burn the Pope in effigy. Eventually, when the 12-year-old boy was killed, because eventually these guys started bringing big wooden bats and clubs and actually going at it with what could become a deadly weapon if it was wielded properly. And so the legislature and the leadership, the city leadership in Boston shut it down and said, you guys need to stop. That's wrong. And the people opposed it. It was a problem. But the Loyal Nine said, hey, that guy can organize street protests. And so they somewhat foolishly allied with McIntosh in order to start demonstrating against the stamps. And when the stamp collector arrived, his name was Olivier or Oliver, he was immediately protested. And they did things that could be considered, you know, threats of violence. I think it's a little bit far to say that. People want to say that because they want to say violence is okay. But they would do things like burn him in effigy, hang him in effigy, march around, you know, with different things that say, hey, we don't like you very much. You're a problem. I don't oppose that. If you want to hang something in effigy, they would do things like march down the street with a coffin and say, this is the Stamp Act is inside. And the British Crown would say, no, you mean the stamp collector's inside. And so there was a debate over, are you going to kill these guys? Well, obviously not. That was not the goal. There were multiple demonstrations led by McIntosh, and eventually the crowd got out of hand. And when they were, eventually they demonstrated and said, these are unpopular, this is wrong, we have local magistrates, and in fact, there were many other colonies, like in Maryland, where the magistrates actually voted together, stood up, there were 12 burgesses, they would be called state legislators today. In fact, in Maryland, they're still called burgesses. They got together and published a declaration that said, this is wrong, we're nullifying it, and we're urging everyone in Maryland not to pay the tax. This was the attitude, and that's what happened in Boston. You had lesser magistrates who were standing up. This wasn't just a bunch of guys getting together. They were functioning under the authority of the local government, and eventually they said, okay, they've used the tax money of the colony to build a small office for Oliver, the tax collector, in which he will collect the tax. It's wrong. And so they went and they tore the building down board by board, and they stamped every single one of the boards with their own stamp and said, you have to pay us tax to get the boards back. So, and that's often, well, see, that's physical violence, it destroyed property. It was Sam Adams who wrote and said, this was a reasonable destruction of property, and this is not a protest. What we're saying is that we actually own this building. This is not some kind of big government building. It's a little shack in which you're going to sit and collect the taxes. You just built it. It's wrong. And we are going to deconstruct it so that you can't collect the tax. Unfortunately, once they started that, McIntosh started leading the men into other things. They burned one of Oliver's sleds. They burned another outbuilding as they were doing some things. And eventually they burnt some of the boards from the little building. And so that's how the fire got started, I think. That made the Loyal Nine nervous. And Sam Adams started saying, hey, we need to rein this in. This is a problem. That was the 14th of August, 1765, excuse me. On the 24th of August, McIntosh took his own initiative and they went and burned down three other houses of government leaders, including the home of the Royal Lieutenant Governor. Okay. And this is when the Loyal Nine said, you may not do this. And they fired him. They got rid of him. And that is when Paul Revere first appears on the scene. We don't know for sure exactly what the relationship was. He was probably around. Adams knew him. Warren knew him. He was one of the mechanics. But that's when he first started appearing. You know, was that late summer 1765 as the leader of the street demonstrations. And from then on, they were very careful not to allow destruction of property or any threat of harm to persons unless there was some reason, something that needed to be done. Never threats to persons. Never, ever. Well, people like to point to the, well, what about the tea? What about the tea? Well, let's first of all talk about the Boston Massacre. So okay. In 1766, the Stamp Act is repealed because the Americans, instead of just rioting, and it had very little to do, there were people who wanted to riot. There are always people who want to riot. And again, you can look at New York, you can look at Massachusetts, you can look at Virginia, you can look at Maryland, you can look at states in the South or colonies in the South. There were people who tried to riot. There were people who tried to tar and feather the tarring and feathering that usually happened with the Stamp Act tax collectors, the stamp tax collectors. And consistently, you see the men we would consider to be founding fathers saying, no, you cannot do that. Do not do harm. Because tarring and feathering wasn't just, oh, let's paint him with blue and throw some feathers on him. You're talking about taking a substance which is a solid at room temperature.
Right.
You have to heat it up to much warmer than your skin in order to put it on someone. It causes burns.
Mm-hmm.
And then putting the feathers on, it does bodily harm, tarring and feathering. Mm-hmm. And so they consistently condemned it. But the fascinating thing there, before we move on, and then I'll shut up, is to note that our forefathers they weren't perfect. They made mistakes. They allied with guys with roughnecks like Ebenezer McIntosh, who was a known troublemaker. They knew he was violent, and they hoped they could control him. In fact, Sam Adams levied taxes against him right before all of this started, and then later paid them. That was amazing. They thought that would be a way of controlling him because he actually did owe tax. And Adams said, hey, if you don't pay him, we're going to put you in jail. And later, he did go to jail for not paying legitimate taxes. And so, you know, he was the founding father's Buffalo guy to some degree, although much less organized.
That's awesome. He was the original. He was the OG Buffalo dude.
The OG Buffalo dude. And apparently almost as problematic. And so we see them saying, no, we're not going to do that. We're not going to join.
Oh.
So there we go. Yep. Sorry, I lost you for a minute.
Yeah, there you go.
So ultimately, you have moving on. You moved on from in 1766, the Parliament repealed the Stamp Act because the colonies went way beyond. They didn't just protest. That was just a minor part of it. They organized boycotts and they stopped the buying of all British goods. That's when stopping, you know, not drinking tea anymore. And by the way, I am drinking black tea today. Mm-hmm. I drink black tea a lot. This is because I'm an American and we can drink what we want.
Yeah, we'll drink what we please, y'all.
That's right.
Yeah,
and thanks to our forefathers.
When you the thing is that with the Boston Tea Party situation, when you involve the issue of tea with people who have a heritage leading back to England, you're dealing in dangerous territory, okay? Because they love their tea.
Oh yes,
they love their tea.
They do, yeah. And I love black tea as well. I drink a lot of it.
Yep,
here's with me more the coffee. But anyway, you know, I haven't got down to yerba mate yet. I do work with many men who trace their lineage to Jeff Durbin, and yep. So they drink.
You need to join the cult. You need to do it.
when you start drinking out of a coconut with a straw.
Yeah.
Or a gourd.
The gourd. Yeah, that's the OG. By the way, I got to say, for all you guys that are like, for all the guys that are into yerba mate now, this can is great. Like, it's good energy. You got all the stuff of the benefits of all this antioxidants, exactly. All the minerals, all the vitamins, all that stuff. But I just want to say that when you drink yerba mate straight out of the gourd, it's a whole different experience. I mean, it's a very different experience in terms of, like, you understand, like, why people started drinking it. Just the calming effects, but also, like, the ability to, like, taste colors and see through walls and understand what somebody's thoughts are before they say them.
Wow.
I mean, it's a whole different experience.
For a minute there, I was worried you were doing a yerba mate ad there with that.
I am. I'm trying to get Goyaki to sponsor our show. So Goyaki, just so you know, I've turned on thousands of people to yerba mate, and you should sponsor Apologia Radio. Thousands.
I work with people in 26 states now who are connected with Action for Life, and they are, oh, look, see, oh, you work with Jeff Durbin, and they're like, hold up the yerba mate.
That's right. That's right. I live off the stuff. I live it. I drink it. I put it on sandwiches, everything. Okay, go ahead.
You pour it on your gelato.
Everything. All right.
What were we talking about again? I don't even remember.
All right, go ahead. Sorry.
So 1766.
Yeah.
The American colonists had organized so well and had boycotted enough British merchandise. And you have to understand that at this time, England was a mercantile empire. That was how they did things. What that means is that they were dependent on people buying their stuff. And the way they got them to do it was by coercion. In some cases, they would legislate their colonies. I don't know if they ever did this in the Americas, but there are many other colonies. You know, the sun never sets on the British Empire. Many of the colonies all over the world, that it was illegal for them to buy certain products, especially textiles, from anywhere but England. And so they were heavily dependent on the American economy. The Americans said, okay, fine, we just won't buy your stuff. We'll make our own. And that is when the DuPont family started making black powder in it here, which was a big deal. Those are the predecessors, the ancestors of the modern DuPont, although they're very different now, and they're not a very nice,
mostly vacuums,
very nice outfit.
Vacuum cleaners and underwear, I think. I don't know.
Yeah, they started with gunpowder. That's how they got here. They started making, because that was one of the things that we didn't make very much of, and so started making our own gunpowder because, hey, we need to make everything. And so it only took a year. By 1766, Parliament said, "We give you. We're not going to tax you this way." Then they tried a tax on sugar, and they tried a tax eventually on tea because they wouldn't give up. But while they were working through how we're going to tax you, they really got down to what they really wanted, which was legislative control, and they passed the Declaratory Acts. And so you have this 10 years of back and forth and back and forth with the colonies refusing to malign the king, refusing to appear seditious or rebellious, and they would petition the king. You can read them. You can look at them again and again. There are petitions to the king. Oh, king, we know this is not you. They were pretty sure it was. But what they would say was, we don't believe you are trying to be a tyrant. We believe, unfortunately, Parliament is out of hand. Please rein in your Parliament. Please tell them to stop legislating in the next jurisdiction over. This is not your jurisdiction. You may not do this. And of course, the great thing about this fight is that the local burgesses, the state legislators, while there were many who didn't want to fight, there were many who were willing to because it was a direct threat on their authority. And they weren't willing to lay down. So you got a decade of this work to do this. And that's when, you know, that's when you saw all of that back and forth and the pleading and the demonstration that, look, We're not trying to be violent. We're not spoiling for a fight. We are not just itching to get go break someone's head. We don't want this. We don't want war. We just want our rights as Englishmen. And you can see it again and again, our rights as Englishmen. Mm. You know, when people say that Paul Revere wrote and said the British are coming, I hate to be a fact checker, and I know there's a meme about this, but it bothers me a little bit every time because he would not say that. He was British. He considered himself to be British. That's laughable. That'd be like saying, I'm coming. We're coming. What he said is the regulars are out. The redcoats are coming. Mm. The king's troops are about to invade. Now, that's a whole different story. Mm-hmm. It's not just that, oh, we hate Britain and we're Anglophiles, which eventually Americans were. After the war, there was a lot of negative sentiment towards England, and understandably so, which has been downplayed in the last century because of the two wars we fought side by side with England. And they became our allies before that. But they were not, our founding fathers were not Anglophobes. They didn't hate the British, they were British. Mm-hmm. And in fact, they had a lot in common with the British citizens in England who were also tyrannized by the Parliament. They, unfortunately, the British citizens, the actual non-colonists, they didn't have much recourse other than to continue trying to win through the common law. But here, we actually had our own parliaments, we had our own governors, we had our own ability, and we were largely governed by the principles won throughout the Protestant Reformation. That's why they call themselves the Roundheads, because they believe the Bible said men should cut their hair. And the Chevalier, or the British would say the Cavaliers. Louis the Chevalier. They were Normans. They were still the descendants of the Norman royalty. They considered themselves, they were Anglicans, and they didn't, and they wore their hair long. If you look at what do the Stuart kings look like, James and Charles and Charles and James, they all have that long flowing hair, and that's why wigs were still a thing. That was the thing. But if you know the Roundheads, they took the wig off and they had hair, well, probably more hair than I do, but not much. It was cut short. And so that's where you had this difference. Now, one of the major differences between the people who are saying that, no, the riots were right, the Capitol riots were fine, we have to fight back, the laughable thing is that they appear to think, that breaking stuff and hurting people will actually get something done. It didn't work for BLM. When Kamala Harris started tittering and laughing to the media about how great the riots were, how they're not going to stop, it's all there. You can go read. It's still there. You can look it up.
Well, hey, hold that thought real fast. We're winding down on time here, but I want to play a clip for everybody to show this. Let me go ahead and just maybe I can expand this. Yeah, there you go. Okay, expand it out. Okay, this is an example of the left and Democrats over the last year when they were burning down cities and rioting and assaulting people and literally killing people. This is some of the responses right here.
I just don't even know why there aren't uprisings all over the country, and maybe there will be.
People need to start taking to the streets. This is a dictator.
You know, there needs to be unrest in the streets for as long as there's unrest in our lives.
Enemies of the state.
Show me where it says that protests are supposed to be polite and peaceful.
Do something about your dad's immigration practices, you feckless.
When they go low, we kick.
How do you resist the temptation to run up and wring her neck? The
biggest terror threat in this country is white men, most of them radicalized right up to the right.
I thought he should have punched him in the face. I said, even if you lost, he insulted your wife.
Yes.
He came down the escalator and called Mexicans rapists and murderers. He said, well, what do you think I should have done? I said, I think you should have punched him in the face and then gotten out of the race. Mm-hmm. You would have been a hero.
I'd like to punch him in the face. I said, if we were in high school, I'd take him behind the gym and beat the hell out of him.
Punch some people in the face.
When was the last time an actor assassinated a president?
They're still going to have to go out and put a bullet in Donald Trump, and that's a fact.
Look, as his character is stabbed to death.
Where is John Wilkes Booth when you need him?
I have thought an awful lot about blowing up the White House.
A Missouri state senator is under investigation by the Secret Service after saying she hopes President Trump is assassinated.
I will go and take Trump out tonight.
And if you see anybody from that cabinet in a restaurant, in a department store, at a gasoline station, you get out and you create a crowd. And you push back on them. And you tell them they're not welcome anymore, anywhere.
and sadly the domestic enemies to our voting system and wow. our honoring our Constitution are right at 1600 Pennsylvania Avenue.
They're not going to stop before Election Day in November, and they're not going to stop after Election Day. And that should be, everyone should take note of that on both levels, that this isn't, they're not going to let up, and they should not.
If you think we're rallying now, you ain't seen nothing yet.
So there you go. There's some examples there. Just, again, consistency.
The problem, I'm sorry, Jeff.
No, go ahead. That's it.
The problem is that our side saw all that and said, oh, well, apparently Biden won because of all the rioting. That is laughable. There again, we're not only are we not paying attention to history, we're not even paying attention to current events. Mm. The polls Biden went way down in the polls, serious drop. That was when things turned around. And Biden, it was so bad that the Biden campaign had to issue a condemnation of the rioting. They actually did, politically. Now, they continued to titter and talk about it quietly, and they kind of like it. But what they learned is that breaking stuff and hurting people does not lead to victory. You know why? Because God doesn't bless it. God does not bless it. And that is why, if you look at the Founding Fathers and look at why were they so careful about people and property, they said it again and again. God will not bless our efforts if we do not obey his law. And that is against his law. We may riot, we may protest, we may demonstrate, we may say things strongly, we may ruin political careers when it's warranted. We may not hurt people and break stuff.
Yeah.
Until someone is actually threatening your life or your property, then you can respond with proportionate use of force. And so now we have a bunch of people who are like, well, we're going to win. Now it's our turn. Now we're going to break into the Capitol. And you're talking about a few hundred out of what, maybe a million? I don't know how many people were there, but when we were there by the Washington Memorial, you could not see the edge of the crowd in any direction. And we were not in the middle of it.
Right.
We were off on one side. And
right.
You still couldn't see the edge. You could get up on a bucket. And you couldn't see the edge of the crowd. So you're still talking about a few hundred. Now, what happens is real quickly, eventually the next thing that people love to talk about and the first thing I'll talk about is what about the Boston Massacre? Well, first of all, recognize that during the Stamp Act riots, which did turn out to be, our side was smart enough to win those fights. We actually won politically. Why? Because we organized, because we did more than just protest, because it wasn't just desperation, because we didn't think, oh my goodness, this is the end of the world. Look around. Look at the people who right now think it's over. That's it. America is done because Donald Trump lost. Look, was there cheating? Almost certainly. Is it a problem? Yes. Does that mean we get desperate and violate what we know to be right in protest? No. That is stupid. That's the problem. Now, is it the end of the world? No, not at all. Our founding fathers recovered from that just fine. Just fine. Is there going to be trouble next week during the inauguration? I hope not. I hope not. But are there going to be idiots? Are there still idiots in the world who claim to be on our side? Yes, there are. What do we need to do? Stand up and say that's wrong. Stop it. As people are doing. You see people all over America now saying, hey, don't go down to the Capitol on the 20th. There's going to be trouble. Stay out of it. Stay out of it.
They're trying to draw you in. Right. Yep.
That's what we need to do. Can we keep everyone from doing stupid things? No, we can't.
You're always going to have a guy with his pants down, showing his crotch with tattoos and bullhorns.
Yeah.
I'm sure.
And what do we do when people act stupidly? We do what we're supposed to do anyway, which is to organize.
Right.
We have to organize and recognize, you know what? If you were paying attention at all during 2020, you recognize that tyranny does not come from the federal government primarily.
Right.
Tyranny comes from your mayor and your governor and the city councils and state legislatures that allow them to tyrannize.
Local. Yes.
Where did the cheating happen? In places where we allowed what we know to be unjust and improper and corruptible voting practices. Untended ballot boxes, no signatures required, absentee voting that is just rife for walk up with a box and just stuff it in there, or city auditors mm-hmm. who didn't pay attention or who were complicit in the cheating. So all of this despair now, despair leading to, well, we have to do something, to rioting, to whatever, it's ridiculous. Stop it. Stand up and act like men.
Amen.
Do what we're supposed to do. Work on the local level.
And that's... a woman. No, I'm just joking.
That's right.
Okay.
Amen right. is a Hebrew We're... word. Apparently, a woman is a Hebrew word.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. All right, we have limited time left. I think we only have about 10 minutes left here. So just help us, though. The Boston Tea Party, though, there's a really cool...
Give us
like 2 minutes of like...
All right.
How is it not comparable?
So the Boston Massacre was 1773. I'm sorry. It was a little bit earlier, and then the Tea Party was a little bit later. And both of them were about whether or not the parliament is going to be able to make law here. The massacre was simply, there were some street demonstrators. They weren't even that violent. And the British soldiers opened fire on them. Well, what happened after that? Our forefathers were careful to frame it not as a riot, but as a massacre. And it's still under this day as a massacre. We were better at technology and we got the message to England faster. We actually got a packet out of Salem, and the packet is a very fast ship. It made it to England and got the message out to the people on the street. And that is where the British leadership and the crown learned of it first, from the street. Their own dispatches got there after that. That was how amazing. Well, it wasn't just it's not just rioting. Okay, so then we get to the Tea Party. Here's what happened. So eventually, after trying to tax paper and business and sugar and a bunch of other glass and a bunch of other things, eventually they decide we're going to tax tea. And that's something everyone drinks. And the parliament thought, checkmate, that's it.
Don't We've be messing them. With the tea. Don't be messing with it.
Tea. Yeah, they'll buy the tea. Okay, so everyone stopped buying tea. They said, well, we're not going to touch it. And so now you've got three ships full of tea that were sitting in Boston Harbor. And the Americans would not allow the tea to be unloaded. And they didn't want it. And the British, the crown, see, I say it too, but the crown was trying to figure out how can we force them to pay the tax. So eventually they conspired with some of the city officials and the governor of Massachusetts to officially pass the sort of a resolution which allowed the colony itself to prepay the tax at when the tea was unloaded. Because it's a sales tax. You have to pay it at sale. But they said, you know what, we're not going to do that. You just unload it. Take it from the ship and put it on the dock. And the colony will use its treasury to pay the tea ahead, and then it will collect the revenue after that. And that will make everybody happy, because now Parliament gets to say, oh, you acknowledge their authority, you paid tax. And so now we're going to pass other laws for you, things like, what can you teach your children? Are you able to read the Bible? What about a state church? And so that was, when it comes down to December 16th, that was the night, that midnight, I believe it was at midnight, that the tea was to be unloaded and the tax was to be perfunctorily paid. Well, at that point, it was no longer private property. The colony had claimed authority over the tea and said, "This is we're going to take this property and use it now and take it." And so, again, was it a protest? Was it a demonstration? Hardly. It was a political maneuver, because if we allowed the colony to pay the tax, the parliament was going to say, the British parliament was going to say, that's it. We're now the authority. And so that is when Sam Adams, Paul Revere, and the Sons of Liberty, made up of several of the men of the Loyal Nine, they had been there in 1765, they'd seen the problems caused, they'd almost lost the fight because of the violence, and they said, this is going to be very carefully controlled street theater. Paul Revere is going to be there himself. And the troublemaker, Ebenezer McIntosh, who burned down the governor's mansion, who sat at governor's house and led the violence, he always claimed to have been at the Boston Tea Party. Most historians say he wasn't there. There was no record. We know who was there. We know many of the ones who were there. But Paul Revere was there, and he was known to have been there. Why? Because they could not afford for it to get out of hand. He carefully handpicked the men who were going to go. They did disguise their identities, many of them did, so that they couldn't be tracked down the next day. But everybody knew Revere was there. They peaceably, there was some noise and they did some stuff, but they walked up to the ships. They asked the ship's captain, please give us the keys to the tea lockers. And the captain was like, yep, here you go. They wanted to get out of there. They were losing money because they had to sit in port when they could have, by this time, they could have been onto the next port to get the next thing and to deliver what the goods that they were taking from the colonies in their mercantile trade. They gave them the keys. They got on board the ships. They carefully unlocked the tea lockers. They took out the tea. They locked everything back up. They caught one guy who was trying to take some of the tea for his own use, and they punished him severely because that would have been theft, and it would have destroyed the entire point. The point wasn't to take the tea. The point was to keep them from having unwillingly and against their will paying the tax. That's when they threw the tea in the harbor. It wasn't a protest. That's laughable. It wasn't some kind of symbol. It was, you're going to tax us for the tea, and if we don't destroy it, Parliament is going to win. They're going to claim complete authority over us. It was a political maneuver.
Mm-hmm.
Now, yep. So they threw the tea over the side. They swept the ships. They cleaned it all up. One lock on the tea chest got broken. I think the key didn't work somehow. A lock got broken. Paul Revere showed up the next day with a new lock and gave it to the captain.
That does not sound like the Capitol breach.
Nope.
Not even remotely.
It does not sound. I thought the Boston Tea Party, at least how people are trying to make a comparison, is like they went in there and they threw it off and like defiance and they broke property, destroyed things, and it's like no.
No. See, that's the foolishness of it. If you want to say it, talk about breaking stuff, talk about the Stamp Act riots. Those were real, but we don't even know enough. Our side doesn't even know enough to talk about it.
Yeah.
It's embarrassing.
Yeah. Yeah. Well.
So I was just going to say, thank you, Zach. That was wonderful. I think there's a lot of things I'm concerned about from last week, but I know one thing that's kind of come up in discussion amongst ourselves and we've come up with Christians that we know. I think there's been two extreme reactions to what happened last week at the Capitol. One is to say all violence is sin, right? There's no righteous violence whatsoever. And the other extreme then is to throw all violence into one pot, into one category, and say violence is good and is a righteous tool. And
with no distinctions.
With
just
no distinctions. Yeah, no categories. You know, to say, because I saw examples of, well, Jesus used violence to clean out the temple. And it's like, okay, that's not at all the same thing as what happened last week. Yeah,
because it was a protest, right? Yeah, it was a political protest.
Let's not forget and answer that it was Jesus' temple.
Exactly.
And he was the priest with the right to cleanse it.
And I think a good example for us would be like, if someone breaks into my home, that's my house, I'm going to use violence to escort that person out of my house.
Escort is a nice word.
Right, exactly. right, but
you mean escort them to heaven.
exactly. But you know, we have to be, we can't be responding to any of this on pure emotion. We need to still think clearly and make decisions based upon principle founded in scripture. You know, and like it's more than ever, we can't be operating off of emotion. We have to be. Make decisions that are well thought out and intentional, and so those are the things I think that just have concerned me. It's like, well, let's think through this carefully through the lens of scripture and not just make decisions based upon emotion.
Well, I think we could probably end on this thought. We are running out of time right here. And the thought of just what you're talking about there, Pastor Luke, and what Zach was, I think, speaking a lot about too, is there's a long historical tradition in terms of how Christians were to see the law, view the law, how the law was king and was supposed to rule over society. That was in the background of everyone's thinking, in the back of all these conversations about the founding of America, the Declaration of Independence, all that stuff. It wasn't just sort of like hodgepodge, we're really upset, we love our rights and we love our freedom, and like, you're a tyrant. And no, there was a long tradition. Of course, you got scripture as the premier example. You've, of course, got the Huguenots developing a lot of very solid Christian theology against tyranny. You've got the Covenanters that fought some long battles against the king and injustice and tyranny. There was a very solid, long-standing historical Christian tradition that was in their minds. Zach, you mentioned last week, too, like Blackstone, Lex Rex. You've got all this stuff. There was an understanding of, like, there's a biblical, righteous, just, consistent way to think through these things. And you mentioned the word proportionate, like in terms of a response, it has to be proportionate because God isn't going to bless an offensive war, and he's not going to bless us if we're abusing other human beings. They were fearful that they didn't want to defy God in fighting for their liberty.
Correct.
They're very serious about that. And so when we think about foundations, there was a very well, Luke, you mentioned like very thought out critical thinking with categories in terms of, is there ever a time, people are asking the thread right now, is there ever a time to respond in a way that is violent? And the answer is biblically, yes, but there's a certain category for that, and it's defensive posture. It's a defensive posture. And of course, like Luke says, someone breaks into my house, I'm going to escort them to Jesus because they're breaking into my home. I don't know what they're trying to do. They could try to hurt my family. In that case, that's a defensive posture. I'm gonna perpetrate violence upon your person, and God is going to be glorified in it. Right. If I kill a guy breaking into my home trying to hurt my family, God is glorified in me ending that person's life. Does that make sense to you? Because that's the category. I have to love my family and my neighbors enough to say, here's an evil man. I'm going to send him to Jesus to glorify God, to protect and love my neighbors. And in the context,
he's actively involved in perpetrating evil.
That's exactly right. So in the context of the American experiment, they thought in the same category way, right? In this category, we are allowed to fight back, but let's avoid that like the plague, and let's honor and glorify God.
That's right. For those who want to know, okay, when do you use violence? You need to study Greg Bahnsen's Just War Theory.
Yes.
You need to study that. That is where it's at. That's where it starts.
Yes.
And the simple answer is it starts from the personal and works to the corporate.
Yeah.
It starts from the personal. And there are some things that change. There are a lot of things that don't. And so you have to start there. And rule number one is violence is not a is not part of protesting.
Yeah.
It's part of defense.
That's right. That's right. Templar said free shipping and handling to Jesus. I like that. Very good. Very, very good. All right. We are running out of time here. Or probably did run out of time on our card. I know Isaac was worried about that today. Zach, you're amazing. I'm sure we're going to have you back in soon. Look forward to seeing you next week for our rally here in Arizona. January 22nd, Arizona State Capitol. We're doing the Rally for Life and Abortion Now is going to be put on a rally. Praise God, Walt Blackman, representative in Arizona, is putting in a bill to criminalize, abolish, and ban abortion in the state of Arizona. As far as I know right now, it's looking really, really, really good before there's even been any really publicity or press conference on it. So we're praising God. We're trusting him. Joy's back on Apologia Radio, and it makes everything better.
Amen.
Even though this was kind of a quiet episode,
I think
for
say a woman.
No,
a woman.
I give you permission to not ever have to say that. You don't have to put the word woman anywhere. It doesn't belong.
Yeah.
Oh no, it was a quiet episode on my part, but I was.
Because we're all learning from
Zach.
Yeah,
taking
notes.
I recommend everyone just listen.
Yes, listen to it again.
Yeah.
I'm going to go back and listen to it again to get some of those tidbits of information that are important. Zach, we love you, brother. We'll see you next week.
Thank you, brothers.
All right. And I mentioned that. I'm going to do it again fast. I know we're running out of time. I'm not sure even if we're even over time at this point with Isaac. But I wanted to invite you all, please come to Arizona. Next Friday is the rally, Arizona State Capitol, January 22nd, 10 a.m. is the press conference, 11 a.m. is the rally. Please come join us. Come meet us. We'd love to meet you. Come stand with us. God is doing amazing things. Local, local, local. That's the answer. What do we do? Build locally. Build your family. Build your church. Build your community. Build local. Call your legislators locally and demand of them that they obey God's law and they do what's right locally. You want to build? You build from those small beginnings. Don't despise the day of small beginnings. You build from those small beginnings where you're at. I hope we can see that our trust isn't in kings and princes. It's in Christ. His gospel is what counts. We've got to transform from the inside, and that moves all the way out. But that has to be local. It doesn't stop from the top. It doesn't start from the top down. It goes from the bottom out. All right. So 11 a.m., January 22nd. Come and join us. Rallyforlifeaz.com. Don't forget also, everyone, go to apologiastudios.com. I'm going to say while you're all here, very important, more important than ever, and I mean this, please hear me. You've seen over the last week what we have been predicting for 5 years. Big tech, censoring, erasing people, all the rest. We're staying on this platform for as long as we'll survive. And we are, of course, looking at the other platforms, and we're building there as well. But we need you to join us at apologiastudios.com. Sign up for all access. Everything, I think, the way things are looking now is going to go back to the old school way of literally going to the website. That person's website. And it's not just apps and all the rest. You can get thrown off of Google Play. You get thrown off of Apple. You get thrown off of Amazon. That could all be a real thing. So we're building a structure so that we cannot be touched. Everything's at apologiastudios.com. Bahnsen U is underway. That is coming. It's a lot to put up there. So please, forgive us for taking some time to put up almost 2,000 pieces of content.
And we're working on apologiastudios.com as well.
Yeah, restructuring the site. All that stuff. So that's all coming, but we need you. We need you. Apologiastudios.com. We need you to partner with us. If you are blessed by this content, you're blessed by the teaching, if you're blessed by the evangelism videos, and by the way, I'm committed this year to get on the street more, to preach the gospel. We'll have cameras on so you guys can hopefully be blessed by the content of us actually engaging in street apologetics and evangelism. I'm going to be doing much more of that this year. Lord willing, that's what my commitment is. all of that, we need you to join us. It only happens because of you. The content from last week at the Capitol, that distinctly Christian commentary that you will find nowhere else. Nope, not bragging. It's just the way things are right now. That distinctly Christian commentary that exists because our partners. Some of you guys have been with us since 2015, since we did all of this with you. And thank you. But it only happens because our partners. So sign up for all access at apologiastudios.com. Don't wait. Do it now. We need you to join us. In order for us to actually build something meaningful that's gospel-centered, Christ-centered, and can speak to these issues, we have to have partners just like you that are in this ministry with us. And so go sign up at All Access, and we'd be grateful if you did. So that's Luke the Bear.
Peace out.
That's Joy the Girl.
See ya.
And I'm so happy she's back. I'm Jeff the Coleman Ninja. We'll catch you next week on Apologia Radio, and I will hopefully see you in Arizona, January 22nd, 11 a.m., Arizona State Capitol. See you next week.